time once again for Community Forum, and we are very lucky to have with us live in the studios this morning, Richard Silverstein. Richard Silverstein has been writing Tikkun Olam, one of the earliest liberal Jewish blogs since February 2003. It focuses on Israeli national security issues and its relations to the Arab world in the region. He is contributor to Truth Out and Haaretz, and also has published in the Christian Science Monitor, the Jewish Forward, Los Angeles Times, Comment is Free, and Al Jazeera English. And he has done segments for Al Jazeera's TV Listening Post and Israel's Channel 10 News. Richard, thank you very much for coming and spending time with us this morning.
Thanks for having me, Mike.
So you are going to be one of the speakers this coming Friday at a forum entitled Syria, a Nation and Region in Crisis. I'm wondering if you can talk about the current situation in Syria, what's happening there. Is it a civil war? Is it a conflict created by outside forces? What's your take on it?
Well, we should start by noting that the United Nations has just increased the estimate of the number of dead in that conflict over the last 2 years up to 93,000. Which makes it one of the worst conflicts now, I would say, probably in the world, just in terms of sheer numbers of dead and destruction to the country. What started as an internal, legitimate internal domestic uprising against the Assad regime 2 years ago has now turned into a full-blown proxy war. In which Assad has his outside supporters in Iran and Russia and Hezbollah from Lebanon, and the rebel forces have their own supporters in Qatar and the United States, we have just heard, is probably going to get involved sending military weapons for the first time. You already have Qatar and Turkey involved, and now Israel is entering the fray. About a month ago, Fox News reported with video of Israeli special forces going across the border into Syria. There are Druze villages there that Israel liaises with closely. So it's just a total mess now. And you know, it's impossible to say at this point what would be the right solution to the conflict. The best I can say is what shouldn't happen, and I think the more outside intervention there is, the worse off the Syrian people will be, and the Syrian civilians are going to bear the brunt of all of this geopolitical positioning that these powerful outside interests are engaged in.
So can you tell us a little bit more about the origins of the original uprising?
Well, you have Assad who, you know, we have to admit that this is a dictator. It's a family, you know, operated business, which he inherited from his father. And they're essentially butchers. We didn't see it so much until the uprising began 2 years ago. But the response to the uprising with the 93,000 dead shows us that this has never really been a legitimate regime. And now its total illegitimacy can be seen in the way it turned on its people and put the full brunt of its military machine into repression of the riots that began. And, you know, it began with people who had legitimate complaints, legitimate grievances, who wanted Syria to be a country that had true democratic, you know, processes, political processes going on, that didn't want to be ruled by dictatorship and by fiat and by corrupt, you know, nepotism, which is the way that that family ran the country. So that, as far as I'm concerned, is totally legitimate. And, you know, it was really in the same kind of perspective as all the other Arab Spring uprisings that happened in Yemen and in Egypt and in Bahrain and places like that. It was just part and parcel of all of that. And it's still part and parcel of what's going on in Turkey right now with the protests that they had in Taksim Square. And these are all, I think, legitimate developments that should be welcomed. The problem is when you get outside forces that are pursuing their own interests, like Russia and Iran and Hezbollah and Israel, it just totally messes up the whole situation. And, you know, that's why I don't want to presume to tell the Syrian people what I think should happen. But I just I want as much as possible for people to just leave Syria alone and let the Syrian people determine what their future should be.
You mentioned earlier that Israel had sent forces in. I believe they'd also have done, as they have over the years, but most recently had done airstrikes.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I shouldn't have omitted that. There were airstrikes, I think it was a month or two ago, in which they were taking out weapons that Iran was transshipping to Hezbollah. There were two sets of airstrikes. There was one in January, which actually killed the senior Iranian Revolutionary Guard general who was the liaison to Hezbollah and to Syria. So their original purpose was to take out some of these advanced missile systems that were being transshipped to Hezbollah that Hezbollah would have been able to use against Israel in the next conflict that will happen there, which we can talk about that issue later on. And so they've had two massive sets of airstrikes inside Syria, preventing Hezbollah from getting its hands on these advanced Iranian weapons. And one of those two, they were attacking Russian-made missiles. So here that goes back again to this issue I was talking about with these advanced weapon systems that are being shipped by Iran, by Russia, you know, into Syria. They'll be used in Syria to protect the regime, and then they might also get to Hezbollah, and then they could use them against Israel, you know, the next time. So that's another example of what I'm talking about how, you know, you have things that begin as legitimate internal grievances that people have, and then they quickly spiral out of control.
So some corporate media is presenting what's happening in Syria as an ethnic conflict. What's your take on that?
Well, to the extent, the longer this goes on and the more the outside forces get involved, the more it becomes a fight between Shiites and Sunnis, which are the two major branches of Islam that are in Syria and in a lot of the other countries in the region. And in Syria, the Sunnis are a majority and the Shiites are a minority. And the Alawites, which is the ethnic group from which the Assad family derives, is an offshoot of the Shiites. So that explains, to an extent, the Iranian involvement, which is a Shiite regime, and Hezbollah as well, which are Shiites. So before the uprising, the what I call the legitimate uprising, began, I don't think this conflict was an ethnic conflict. But now you have al-Qaeda getting involved with this group called the al-Nusra Front, which is a Sunni, radical Sunni group. And, of course, unfortunately, because the Assad family is Alawite, the Alawites in Syria are bearing the brunt. Many more Alawites have been killed of the 93,000 that out of proportion to their numbers in the population. So they're bearing the brunt of this, and it just becomes worse and worse. And it becomes an ethnic conflict, which it probably didn't start out as. And the hope of people who want to see eventually a peaceful resolution is to eliminate that ethnic aspect of things and see if there can be a resolution where all of the ethnic groups aren't targeting each other for ethnic reasons, that there are legitimate reasons to oppose the regime, its corruption, its nepotism, its repression, and then there are illegitimate ways to exploit those ethnic grievances and the violence that comes out of that.
And do you see the exploitation of the of ethnic grievances as advantageous to the larger outside forces like the U.S. and Russia?
Yeah, absolutely. I think the worst that can happen is if the radical extreme elements on either side end up winning. So you could – the al-Nusra Front are known as some of the best fighters on the rebel side. So it's possible that they could come out of this as being the dominant force on the rebel side. And if that happens, then I just don't see any way that you can have any kind of quick resolution of this conflict. They tend to be the best funded. They tend to be the best organized militarily. And if they end up being the best organized politically, it could be a situation like worse than in Egypt, where you had the Muslim Brotherhood ending up winning the elections there, but they didn't have a military force at their disposal because they had a strong Egyptian military. In Syria now, the only strong military organized force you have is the government. And if al-Nusra becomes the sort of I'm trying to think of the right word here, but if they become the force that's representing the other side, dominates politically, and even maybe takes over from Assad, I don't have much hope that that is going to be a situation that will, you know, end well or end peacefully for Syria.
So how does the U.S. present itself as supporting the rebels, which contain al-Nusra and al-Qaeda?
Right, right. It's very difficult because, you know, I would say one of the reasons that the conflict has gone on as long as it has is that the rebel factions have not been able to present a coherent front. There's too much dissension in the ranks. You know, there's mostly Sunnis among the rebels, but there are some other elements as well. They just can't get themselves together. They can't, you know, elect a leader. They can't figure out a platform. And this is a recipe really for continuing conflict ad infinitum, ad nauseum. And what they need to do is figure out how they can come together. I mean, in Libya, even though there was a lot of dissension among the rebel factions, they managed to cohere enough that they could have a military force that would take over, and then they could have a political leadership. Now, Libya is still not a totally coherent picture. The militias are still too powerful in Libya. But in Syria, you're not even at that point where they can cohere enough to take over from Assad, to beat him on the battleground and to take over the country. Something has to happen there. That the United States is the reason I'm opposed to you. If there was a more coherent rebel force, I wouldn't be as opposed as I am to the United States getting involved militarily. In Libya, we got involved and we helped overthrow Gaddafi. If we did that same thing now, there would be no alternative for us. And we're going in on the side of Qatar and Turkey, which are arming the rebels already. But we don't know what is going to happen. I mean, we could reap the whirlwind and come out with a new Sunni extreme version of Gaddafi or of, you know, any of the al-Qaeda leaders that you want to talk about. And that would be a disaster. That would be sort of creating a new Afghanistan, a new Taliban right in the heart of, you know, Afghanistan is bad enough, but at least it's off, you know, kind of in the background of the region. In Syria, Syria's at the heart of the Middle East. You know, you've got Turkey in the north, you've got Iran on one border, you've got Iraq, you've got Israel, Lebanon. I mean, if we want to talk about a powder keg that could erupt and engulf the entire region and maybe even the world, that could be where it would happen. So I'm very worried about the idea of the U.S. intervening when we don't know what it is that we are going to reap if we do that.
I believe they just had an article in yesterday's New York Times about Qatar shipping weapons from Libya to Syria to the rebels.
Yeah, I didn't see that, but it doesn't surprise me, and I've heard similar stories about that. There's also in Qatar, there's going to be a meeting today of the rebels trying to come up. I think the international community is involved. I heard on NPR, I heard William Hague speaking. So I think they're going to be continuing their efforts to try to see if they can come up with a coherent opposition force. But what I have seen so far hasn't been very hopeful.
And it appears we keep seeing reports off and on that specific sides are using chemical weapons in Syria, that apparently being the precursor for the U.S. getting involved.
Right. There have been these stories reported for the past couple of months on either side. I mean, I think that most legitimate observers and analysts feel that if chemical weapons have been used, it hasn't just been by one side. But the U.S. feels that it has enough evidence to support the idea that Assad used chemical weapons in certain narrow instances, and they can they have enough scientific evidence to support that. Now, you know, whether, you know, we've seen in Iraq that WMD is this convenient excuse for allowing us to do whatever it is that we wanted to do to begin with, and we needed, you know, we needed our Gulf of Tonkin, you know, the other side creating an incident that we could use to do whatever it is that we wanted to do to begin with. So if you know, Obama has been goaded really by McCain and by the Republicans and the liberal interventionists like Samantha Power and Susan Rice, who are taking new roles in the administration, into considering intervention on a more robust way. And so WMD and chemical weapons serve as a convenient excuse to do that. I don't feel that, you know, use of chemical weapons is obviously unacceptable in any sense. But whether this happened and on what scale, and whether it deserves the kind of response that we're going to escalate this conflict, I can't say.
All right. So Iran just had elections.
Right.
What is your analysis of the outcome of those?
Right. I see the elections as being very, very helpful to the overall context, political context of what's going on. It's true that the election of a quote-unquote moderate, Hassan Rouhani, who's been an ally of Hashemi Rafsanjani, who is the, you know, I would call him the person within the establishment in Iran who has been the most willing to be critical of the clerical regime and the excesses of it. So Rouhani is an ally of Rafsanjani. He was elected in an election result that shocked the whole world and surprised even, I think, Iranians that hoped for change. They all if you look at the coverage of the election up until the actual election, everybody outside Iran, I think, thought that it was going to be a regime supporter who was going to be the winner. No one would have predicted, I think, that someone who would be critical of the clerical system in Iran. I shouldn't say that. That's overstating it. He's not critical of the clerical system, but he's critical of the worst aspects of it, the kind of the prison regime, the draconian excesses of the Basij, you know, the Revolutionary Guard, thugs that attacked the people in 2009. And he's really the calm sort of centrist face of the establishment in Iran. And it bodes well for the possibility of a resolution of some of these really thorny issues that Iran and the United States have faced over the Iranian nuclear program. He was the Iranian negotiator under the last reformist regime when President of Iran was Khatami. He was his nuclear negotiator, so he knows a huge amount about the nuclear program. Even though the supreme leader, the Ayatollah Khamenei, is the one responsible for the nuclear program and making decisions about how it would be dealt with. I think that Rouhani is so well placed and well thought of in so many circles in Iran that he can't help but be able to play a role in figuring out how to deal with this nuclear issue. The United States would be very, very smart and well advised to take Rouhani seriously as a leader, to put forward serious proposals involving serious compromises on both sides, which it hasn't done until now, that would meet with a receptive response from the Iranians, because we are not liable to get a more receptive interlocutor than someone like Rouhani in Iran. If we don't take advantage of this window of opportunity, it would be a great, great travesty. I'm hoping, even though I've been very disappointed in many of the policies that Obama has developed in his first term, including drone strikes, targeted killings, civil liberties issues, spying, all of those issues. And I've been unhappy with his Iran policy as well. But I think that he's pragmatic enough and clear-eyed enough to understand the opportunity that presents itself here. And he really needs to respond, to rise to the occasion. And I'm hoping that he will.
Do you have a sense what Israel's response to the elections were?
Yes. Bibi is, Abba Ibn once said about the Arabs, they never lose an opportunity to lose an opportunity, never miss an opportunity to miss an opportunity. And in my case, I reverse it and I say, Israel's current leadership never misses an opportunity to miss an opportunity. And Bibi is very sour about Iran. And the fact that the Iranians chose a leader who is the worst possible leader for Israel, for the leadership of Israel, in terms of wanting to escalate the conflict and choose a military solution to the conflict and attacking Iran and attacking its nuclear facilities, Rouhani's victory is the worst possible outcome, because it will allow the anti-interventionists like myself and those who are in policymaking positions in the United States and other places in the world to say we need to give diplomacy a chance. We need to give negotiations a chance. We need to explore other avenues than we have. We need to consider putting the sanction regime on the table as something we would be willing to turn away from if the Iranians respond positively to that option. The Israelis want the worst policies to be in effect, and the Israeli leadership has wanted a military solution for years to this. And only by the skin of our teeth have we not seen Israel actually. I was going to use the word invade, but I don't think they ever wanted to put boots on the ground. But airstrikes and missile strikes against Iran were something that the Israeli Prime Minister has wanted to do since at least 2009, we know, 2010. So he has to take that off the table, and he is just furious about that. And he just reiterated Israel's most extreme position, which is that Israel will not tolerate any uranium enrichment on the part of Iran. Now, even the most, I won't say even the most hardline people in policymaking positions, but those who are at least centrists or moderates in terms of Iran in that aspect, understand that Iran has to be allowed, even under the nuclear protocols, international nuclear protocols, it is entitled to enrich uranium up to a certain point. It may not be entitled to enrich it to weapons grade. That's an argument that, that's a separate argument. But even under the most extreme interpretations of the Nuclear Proliferation Treaty, Iran is entitled to enrichment. Israel's position is no enrichment at all. And if Iran enriches, then it's liable to, face a possible attack by Israel or by the United States. That's the Israeli position. And he just reiterated that. So it's in his interest for there to be the most radical regime possible in Iran, for Iran to behave in the most bellicose way, because then it only reinforces the bellicosity of his own position and what he wants to do there. So even though I have to say there are very strong forces within Israel that do not want that kind of approach, and they are some very powerful elements. The Israeli army itself doesn't want to be put in a position of attacking Iran. The intelligence chiefs, the Mossad, the military intelligence chiefs, the domestic intelligence chief, they all are united in thinking that this is a really bad approach. And in 2010, they all three in a meeting, these intelligence chiefs, basically shouted down Netanyahu and his then defense minister, who was basically putting forward to a security cabinet an attack on Iran as being in the cards. And they united together to force the conversation to renounce this. Bibi was so exasperated and angry at this that all of those intelligence chiefs are no longer in those positions. So he finessed the situation so that he got rid of them all, or they all retired, and there are new people in those roles. But even the new people in those roles share the views of the former people that they replaced. So they're more junior than the people they replaced. Those people, Mayor Dagan, Yuval Diskin, and Aharon Yadlin, were very senior, very powerful, had their own sort of power centers in the government circles. And the new people are kind of just feeling their sea legs and don't yet have that kind of might to bring to bear to prevent something like this. But I think Obama has made it clear to Bibi that he will not approve, not allow, not go along with an Israeli attack. So I think that's one of the key reasons why Israel hasn't done that yet.
Well, with that, we are just about out of time. We're talking with Richard Silverstein. He is a writer at Tikkun Olam. And how can people find your blog?
Yeah, let me talk about the blog and also about the event on Friday. The event is again is called Syria Nation and Region in Crisis, and it will be on Friday, the 28th, at 7 p.m. at the United Temple Methodist Church in the U District. The address is 1415 Northeast 43rd Street in the U District. That's across from the law school. My other speaker joining me will be Rita Zawada. Rita is one of the leading humanitarian relief activists who's trying to help the Syrian refugees, and she is now in Jordan trying to help the 1.5 million Syrian refugees there. And she will be returning and reporting on that trip and the relief that she brought and the situation in Syria and in the areas where the refugees are situated. And my blog is called Tikkun Olam, and the URL for my blog is my name, richardsilverstein.com. I welcome your listeners making a visit to the blog and learning about all of these issues.
Very good. Well, with that, we're unfortunately out of time. I want to thank you very much for coming in and spending time with us this morning.
Thanks for inviting me, Mike. I appreciate it.